Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this year's race for the White House, a new kind of political action committee has emerged as a major source of campaign cash. It's the Super PAC. Super PACs have already given millions of dollars to candidates, and while they are required to be transparent, it can be very difficult to determine just where the money is coming from. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Bob Biersack from the Center for Responsive Politics. It is the nation's leading research group that tracks money in U.S. politics and its effect on elections and public policy. It is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group. It's based in Washington, D.C. And we'll be talking about campaign finance in the era of the Super PAC. Questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. We hope people can be brief, but your questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455, and you can send us an email if you'd like to do that. That is will-talk@illinois.edu. So your questions, comments are welcome. Just one more quick word of introduction about our guest. For 30 years until he retired, Bob Biersack served in key roles at the Federal Election Commission, including spending nearly two decades as the chief statistician and 5 years as head of the FEC's press office. Most recently, he served as the commission's special assistant to the staff director. He designed and implemented new ways of leveraging technology to expand access to campaign finance information, including the commission's maps of presidential and congressional fundraising. And if you would like to find out more about the organization, the Center for Responsive Politics, they have a website. There's lots of information there on subjects like lobbying and political action committees. And the website is opensecrets.org. So you can go right there and find out more. And questions again, welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. And Mr. Biersack, hello.
Good morning.
Hey, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
I'm happy to be here.
I wanted to start with some basics here and maybe first talk about basically about political action committees, and then we can talk a little bit about these two court rulings, Citizens United and then Speech Now, and how they changed things. But first, just to talk basically about political action committees, I was actually kind of surprised to learn that they have been around so long that the very first one was actually organized on behalf of Franklin Roosevelt. So this was actually in the mid-40s, the very first PAC came into being.
That's right. And they've all, from that time until very recently, the idea was that organizations could accumulate voluntary contributions from, in the case of companies, from their executives and management employees, or even from their shareholders. In the case of, for example, unions, from their members, other kinds of associations, from their members, collecting individual contributions of personal funds from those folks, where there were limits on how much they could contribute, and then those monies would be pooled, and they could make contributions, also limited contributions, to candidates for federal office, for Congress, or for president. A chance for people to have maybe a little more financial push in terms of their ability to be heard in the political process, but still individual money limited in relatively small amounts, but the chance to accumulate it and try to make a difference that way. That was the original conception for PACs, and as you say, they started really in the 40s. They were much more structured and regulated after the Watergate era in the early 1970s, when the law was changed to create, for example, the Federal Election Commission and to impose some real restrictions on how this process worked. It had the effect of structuring this kind of way of participating financially in elections, and we had that system for more than 30 years.
All right. So limits on the amount of individuals, may contribute, mm-hmm. and on the amount the PAC could give to an individual candidate. And
that's right.
That has not changed.
No,
however,
that's right.
What
that
did change was there was something else important. And before, these groups were barred from making contributions from their general treasury. So this is where we come to Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, this decision by the Supreme Court. How did that change things?
The Citizens United decision by itself did one very important thing. It said that, as you said, in the past, that corporations or the unions or the associations directly themselves could not contribute money, could not even spend money specifically advocating the election or defeat of candidates. They couldn't use their treasury resources, their corporate resources or their union dues payments for that purpose. In the Citizens United decision, the Supreme Court said that those restrictions were counter to the First Amendment free speech rights that even entities like corporations and unions have. And so, therefore, as long as the spending is truly independent of the candidates involved, there can't be limitations, there can't be a prohibition on companies or unions spending their own treasury funds in elections that way. Mm-hmm.
Now, there was another decision, and it seems to me that it hadn't gotten as much attention, or at least my feeling is in reading about super PACs, the thing that always gets referred to as Citizens United. This is a decision, a ruling, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. This was something, a case called SpeechNow.org versus FEC.
Right.
How did this add an additional wrinkle?
It has the effect of putting this money together. It was really a pretty straightforward case and a real problem that existed for a long time. Since 1976, even though corporations and unions couldn't spend their own money, individual people could spend unlimited amounts of their personal funds to advocate the election or defeat of candidates. The court had ruled in the Buckley decision, 1976, that there couldn't be any restrictions on that. And so that had been true for a long time. The problem with that speech now brought to the court was that, okay, I as an individual can do this without any limitation. But as soon as I sit down with three or four of my friends or neighbors or whatever, and we all decide we want to do this, again, independent of the candidates, now suddenly, because we're doing it together, we become a political action committee. And then we're forced into these restrictions where I could, as a person, only give $5,000 per year to that kind of organization. Mm-hmm. And so how is there any logic to a system where, as long as I do it by myself, there are no restrictions, but if I start to associate with others, and again, there's this basic constitutional association, right, now suddenly I'm severely restricted in terms of how much money I can use that way. And the D.C. Circuit, as you said, was certainly sympathetic to that argument, and so said, yes, no, as long as an organization specifically says that they will not make contributions to candidates or they won't make contributions to party committees, because the courts have always said that the risk of corruption, which is really the way that the government is allowed to restrict any of this behavior, the risk of corruption comes when you're exchanging money when you're giving money to somebody, but not necessarily when you're spending it on your own. So the combination of the fact that now organizations could be created, and this was really the dawn of super PACs. Organizations could be created that said, we're not going to contribute to candidates, we're not going to contribute to parties, we're only going to make independent expenditures. And so, therefore, there can be no limit on how much I, as a person, can contribute to this organization that's going to do that. Now you add on the layer of Citizens United, which says that corporations and unions can also participate this way, and you have the super PAC that can take unlimited funds from just about any source. Mm.
You know, and what really strikes me is while we have heard a lot about the fact that this is all about organizations and their ability to organizations or groups and their ability to make contributions, and most often that it seems in news stories it's always said, well, what we're talking about here is unions or corporations. What seems to be the case is that, at least in the GOP primary so far, the activities that we've seen by super PACs, a significant number of them seem to be really a single person.
Yeah. In some ways, what we're seeing is sort of the more things change, the more they stay the same. Mm-hmm. There have always been, probably through the whole history of the country, groups of individuals who had lots of financial resources of one kind or another, usually personal funds, maybe combined with privately held companies or things like that, who were, for ideological reasons or economic reasons or whatever, very interested in the political process. And so it's kind of a natural tendency for them to try to use those resources to bring them to bear on a elections and campaigns. That's not necessarily new. What's new is now they have a much clearer path and a much more specific path to use both their personal funds, and if they control a company or an organization, that organization's funds as well, to make very specific and explicit kinds of ads or whatever that are involved in elections. So yeah, it has been primarily individual people. This small group of people who feel very strongly about either certain issues or the way the country should be organized, and who are trying to influence these elections.
Hmm. And if people are interested in looking at the top PACs, top super PACs, according to how much money they contributed, if they go to opensecrets.org and go to click on super PACs, they will see them, beginning with one called Restore Our Future, which supports Mitt Romney. And the number two is something called Winning Our Future, which is something that supports Newt Gingrich. And if you looked on the list, it seems like overwhelmingly of the top 20, most of them are, their viewpoint is conservative. Now, I don't know if that's just an artifact of the fact that here on the GOP side we have a primary, and on the Democratic side we don't. There certainly are both liberal and conservative super PACs. If you look at all of them, does it roughly break down as about 50-50?
No, not necessarily in terms of the money, not yet. but I think you're right. Part of the logic is that because there was a primary race on the Republican side, and one of the things that I'm not sure anybody necessarily anticipated, but isn't so surprising maybe now, is that we would have these committees that would be specifically aligned with particular candidates. So Restore Our Future being really, while technically, legally independent from the Romney campaign, lots of leadership people in that organization who worked for Romney's 2008 campaign or previously, and similar situations for these other groups that are focused on specific candidates. They had a big incentive to raise money at this point in the process and to try to influence these early primaries especially. So really, I suppose it's not surprising that they're dominating the process now. As we get to the point where nominees are established for both parties, where congressional elections become more visible, you know, there are going to be close contests in lots of different states in the Senate and also lots of close House races, then we're going to see a shift to different kinds of organizations that are focused on those races. And the distribution conservative versus liberal may well change there. There's nothing inherently about this process that advantages one side or the other. It's just the way it's worked out this year, I think.
Let me very quickly introduce again the guest for anybody who has just tuned in. We're talking this morning in this hour of focus with Bob Biersack. He is a senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington, D.C. This is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that's interested in tracking money in politics. And if you'd like to find out more, you can look at their website, which is opensecrets.org. Our guest, Bob Biersack, before going to work there at the Center for Responsive Politics, spent 30 years working at the Federal Election Commission. He dealt a lot with numbers and statistics, and we're really pleased that he could be here talking with us. And we're talking about campaign finance issues, and the big thing that has been so much in the news just recently is this new kind of political action committee, the Super PAC. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And if you would prefer to send us an email, you can certainly do that, will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to come back here to a point that you were just making, and that is that the deal here on the Super PAC was that they could spend this unlimited amounts of money, but the spending had to be independent of the campaigns. That in the term of art here is that you read is they are not supposed to, quote unquote, coordinate with the campaign.
Right.
But the fact is that it seems very clearly that there are, as you say, there are connections in the sense that we have super PACs that clearly are acting on behalf, it seems, on behalf of a particular candidate. So you have to ask, well, can they still work for that candidate without coordinating, and does this rule about not being, you know, being independent of campaigns, is that really kind of an empty rule?
It's empty is a pretty broad word.
you can use whatever word you would think would be appropriate.
Yeah, it's hard to. One of the things that's true in this era of politics is that there really aren't very many secrets anymore. There aren't very many strategic choices or kinds of messages or things that would be important in a campaign that aren't pretty widely publicly available. And so when you see ads from these super PACs that reinforce the messages that the campaigns are trying to make, it's not necessarily because somebody sat in a room and they said, okay, you do this today and I'll do that tomorrow, and this is how we'll magnify our voices. It's because people pay attention to what's on campaign websites or what the candidates themselves are talking about in on the stump or in their own ads. And it's not rocket science to say, well, okay, here's how we can use this money to magnify this voice or to reinforce this message. Now, the flip side of that is that I think, and we've already heard from a number of the presidential candidates, even the ones who were most advantaged, theoretically, by this spending, that it makes them a little nervous. Candidates are really kind of uncomfortable with the idea that some big outside force, even if it's an outside force that likes them, can complicate the communication that's going on politically. It may be that the group decides to emphasize an issue, that the candidate's thinking about and talking about and is also interested in, but isn't what they want to focus on at this particular time or in this particular state or in other kinds of contexts, and they don't have control over that in an important way. And so I think this is a two-edged sword, and I think every candidate feels that way. Yes, you'd like to have all the help you can get, but you'd really want to be able to control it. And to the very specific extent of saying, you do this now and I'll do this later, they can't do that.
Let me ask you about something else. The super PACs are required to disclose their donors. Sort of the hitch here is that in a non-election year, they only have to do that every 6 months,
right,
semi-annually. And in fact, they were, I do believe they were due to disclose their donors. They were supposed to do that, say, at the end of January, and the last disclosure had actually been last July. So there's kind of a long lag time. And while people think that maybe the answer to this, the only answer really to this problem is transparency, that because of that rule that says, well, you know, you really only have to disclose semi-annually if that's what you want to do, doesn't really provide much transparency.
No, that's right. That was a real problem this year. And it's an example of how technology and the way we live our lives get beyond specific rules that were written, you know, two generations ago. In the 1970s, when this disclosure regime was set up, everything was on paper and submitted in reams of paper for much smaller amounts of money. Now, when everything can be done electronically and instantaneously, that kind of schedule doesn't make sense anymore. But it's written into the law, and so it's something that requires congressional action to change. Now, there were some aspects of this that made it even worse. That's true. It's true that these committees could file semi-annual reports in non-election years. But if they did that, and there was a primary election that came before the time got close to that primary before the end of the year, then they were supposed to file a special, what's called pre-primary election report, which would have covered that full period of since July up through about 3 weeks before the election. The problem is that the Federal Election Commission has allowed people to switch their timing for when they report. In fact, encourages it for good administrative reasons, not related to this. They said if you decide you want to file monthly reports, then you don't have to submit these pre-election filings. And so, maybe cleverly, maybe innocently, but certainly consistently, a lot of these super PACs got up to the point where that report would have been due, and they said, "Oh wait, we're going to change and file monthly." And so, therefore, we don't have anything due until the end of January. That was a bureaucratic problem. That was a technical trick, if you will, that these committees were able to use, and that if we're really committed to transparency across the board, which includes the agencies that are responsible for enforcing this process and administering it, then that really, the fact that was allowed was pretty problematic.
Yeah.
But now they're on monthly schedules, and so we'll get a little better reporting. But even that's pretty arcane. You know, there was a lot of activity that happened in January. Obviously, lots of very important primaries, big spending. We've heard about these huge $10 million contributions, $5 million from husband and wife to support Newt Gingrich, for example. We haven't seen any of that yet, and we won't until February 20th. Because the timing for these monthly filings is almost 3 weeks after the end of the month. Again, a throwback to the old paper days, but silly in the context of the way things work today.
Yeah, we should talk about the dollar amounts here, because they're, to me, they're pretty staggering. I just want to make sure that I actually read this right, that what you report is that so far, super PACs have reported over $98 million, that is, like, they've taken in that much money, and that they have spent over $46 million. Do I have that right?
That's right. and the spending money amounts are a little bit ahead in terms of the calendar of the fundraising amounts. That $98 million is what these groups have raised through the end of the last year. The spending is a more modern kind of disclosure requirement. So if you start running these ads advocating the election of defeated candidates, then you have to report the spending within 24 hours of the time that the ad starts to appear. So that $46 million that they've spent so far is much more current. It probably reflects at least these direct expenditures, these very specific expenditures through the last couple of days.
So if you take a look at amounts of money spent on behalf of political candidates, whether or not they're tied to the campaigns or not, I mean, if you just try to ask a question, okay, how much money is being spent? Mm-hmm. Is this, and can one say that these court decisions and the rise of the super PAC means that more money is coming into the process now than did 4 years ago?
No, well, not necessarily. 4 years ago, the 2008 campaign was pretty extraordinary in that it was an open seat, so there were competitive election races on both parties. And we had really, really extraordinary fundraising totals for many of those candidates. So, in fact, if you look at the candidates themselves, and compare 2008 to 2012. 2012 is way behind. So what these groups are doing in some respects is making up for the relatively limited fundraising capabilities of these that we've seen from these candidates in this cycle.
And I suppose one of the big things that was different about last time around was that candidate Hillary Clinton opted out of the federal financing structures. They said, okay, that money that they could have, they said, no, we don't need that money. And truly, they didn't need it. And what they got is then that meant there were no limits on the amount of money that they could raise. John McCain, he opted in. He stayed in. Mm-hmm. And then I suppose there are some people who say, you know, that actually ended up putting him as a disadvantage because it did indeed place limits on the amount of money that he could raise.
That he could spend in the general election.
Yeah.
The public funding program for presidential candidates, which started in the mid-70s, the 1976 Jimmy Carter election was the first one that had public financing in it. It always had two segments, one for the primaries and one for the general election. In the primaries, you could get matching funds. So if individual people contributed up to $250 to your campaign, as long as you got enough people in enough different states, you could get a match, a dollar for dollar, for that $250. And for a long time, everybody participated in that process. But that came, as most things do, with some restrictions as well. And one of them, one of the really important ones, was there was a limit then on how much you could spend overall during all the primaries and in each state, which was based on population. So it became really hard to run effective campaigns in small population states like Iowa and New Hampshire, which were also really important because they were first. And it became hard for somebody who was successful and became the nominee to stay within the spending limits before they got to the convention. Then in the general election, there was a lump sum grant that was given to each of the nominees, pretty significant amount of money, in order to run their general election campaign. So basically from Labor Day until Election Day. And for example, in 2008, John McCain got a grant of $84 million. To run the general election period. And most of the time people thought that was sufficient to be able to run an effective campaign. And in fact, Barack Obama was the first major party nominee to turn that part of the public funding program down and raised a stunning amount of money. I mean, no one would have predicted that a nominee in a presidential race could raise $750 million for the whole process, which is what he was able to do. So that completely changed the logic for the public funding program. And in fact, it's virtually entirely dormant now. Nobody expects that either of these candidates in the general will take that grant money. It just pales in comparison to what they'll raise. And nobody participated in the matching fund program in the primaries, with the exception now of Buddy Romer, who just qualified for matching funds a couple of weeks ago, which tells you sort of how important that process is today.
Yeah, just one other thing that I think is kind of interesting. We talked about the amount of money being spent. What is kind of interesting is that it seems that, and you can check me if I don't quite have this right, that there has actually been less candidate-sponsored advertising this year than 4 years ago. And I would think that if I'm a candidate, actually, if it's good for me, if there's somebody who's sympathetic to me, is spending their money running ads saying, if my opponent wins, it's going to be the end of the world, because then I don't have to worry about that. And that really allows me to save my money, because I don't have to, not only do I not have to tarnish my hands with that kind of message, but also I don't have to spend my money to put it on.
That's right. I don't think there's any question that particularly for the campaigns that are not Mitt Romney, for Newt Gingrich, for Rick Santorum, for Ron Paul, who really don't have very much money to spend on their own, none of the three, it's pretty important in the logic of staying in the race, and maybe in the success that they've had in one place or another, that somebody else is available. Somebody else is stepping up. Yeah, I think that dynamic's pretty clear.
Yeah. In this part of Focus, we're talking about campaign finance. Particularly, we're talking about the rise of the super PAC. Our guest is Bob Biersack. He's a senior fellow with the Center for Responsive Politics. We'll have more in just a moment. First, we'll take a short break. This is Focus.
Thursday, WILL and its partners, Common Ground Food Co-op and Eastern Illinois Food Bank, team up again to fight hunger in our community. This year, for every pledge made to WILL, Common Ground Food Co-op will donate the cost of 8 meals to Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Your pledge supports your source for programs that educate and inform and fights hunger in our community.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics for you every week. In the second hour today, we'll be talking about the world of theoretical physics. Our guest will be Lisa Randall. She is a physicist herself. She teaches at Harvard, and she's the author of a book that we'll talk about that's titled Knocking on Heaven's Door. It's about what we are learning now about how the world is put together and how it works, and particularly how this device that has been in the news recently, this thing called the Large Hadron Collider, is adding to our knowledge about the universe and how it works. That's hour number two. Tomorrow morning, the topic is nutrition. That's something that we do every month on the program. The guest will be Karen Chapman Novakovsky. She's a professor of nutrition here at the U of I. And then also another kind of health-related thing. Tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Stephen Amidon, who is a novelist, and Thomas Amidon, who is a cardiologist. And together, they are authors of the book The Sublime Engine, A Biography of the Human Heart. You can check the schedule, listen to past programs by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we're talking about campaign finance and talking particularly about the rise of the super PAC. And our guest for the program is Bob Biersack. He is at the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington, D.C. He's a senior fellow there. He's somebody who spent a lot of years dealing with this particular subject. In fact, for something like 30 years until he retired, he served in a number of key roles at the Federal Election Commission, including nearly 20 years as the chief statistician and 5 years as head of the FEC's press office. And now he's with this organization called the Center for Responsive Politics. And if you'd like to look at their website, go to opensecrets.org. That is their website. And, of course, here, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, you know, the thing, you talked a little bit earlier about how actually the super PAC, while it can be advantageous for a candidate, it also makes them a little nervous because they don't have control. And certainly one thing that we know, in there have been a number of surveys that have said voters don't really think this is such a great thing either. For example, the Pew folks at the Pew Research Center did a poll, and 65% of voters said that they thought this decision in Citizens United has actually been bad for politics. And that seemed to actually cut across party lines. Seemed that both Democrats and Republicans said that this was not such a good thing. So it makes candidates uneasy. People like you, good government folks, are unhappy about it. A lot of voters seem to be really unhappy about it. But we seem to keep running up against the Supreme Court that says, hey, money, speech, it's the same thing. And you can't place, they're very careful about saying what kind of limits you can place on contributions. So if one wants to change this, where do you go?
In the short run, I think you can only work around the edges. In the long run, if you wanted to comprehensively change it, then obviously you'd need to amend the Constitution, and that's a pretty tall order. Well, I think if you were to play the devil's advocate perhaps for a minute, if you were to take the other side of this, you would say that the court's kind of doing exactly what it should in terms of, we're not concerned about public opinion, we're not trying to make law in the way that's popular, we're trying to make law in the way that's right or consistent, at least, with these fundamental principles. And I think the real problem in campaign finance regulation has always been that there are two pretty fundamental principles that are fighting with each other here. One is, and the one that's emphasized in this and other decisions, is this idea that any restriction on my ability to speak politically, and most especially my ability to challenge the government, to complain about what they're doing, to express my dissatisfaction with what's happening, any restriction on that is a real serious problem. And that's pretty fundamental to our DNA. You know, that's the way as Americans we've always thought, that independent speech, my ability to express myself, my ability to be involved in politics is just a fundamental good, and that the government itself should really have a hard time restricting that. That bumps up against this notion that the electoral system is one of the examples of a place where your success economically, the fact that you maybe had the good luck of being born wealthy, other kinds of things that accumulate resources, the financial resources, that shouldn't be the determining factor in the way that we govern ourselves. That one person, one vote has some meaning, and that everybody's desires and perspectives on issues and how the government should work are equally important. And so when those two things collide, when we're concerned about the accumulation of wealth being having too much influence on the electoral process versus the government not being allowed to restrict any individual or now, I guess, any entity's ability to speak freely, that's really hard to navigate. And the court so far, in the way that it's structured now, the people there now believe, I think, at least five of them do, that if you're going to make a mistake, you need to make a mistake on the side of this free expression.
Well, it's pretty clear that, first of all, it's pretty clear that the court has said, say, if I'm running for office and if I have $1 million, that I can spend every last dime on my own campaign if I so choose.
Right.
Or that if I have $1 million and I want to go out and spend, create $1 million worth of advertising that says either candidate A is a great guy or candidate B is a terrible guy, as long as I'm not working with the campaign, I can do that.
Right.
How is it that it passes the court that it says that if you're running for office, I can only give you so much money?
Basically, what they've decided is that there is this real possibility for money to corrupt the political process. In its purest form, it's just bribery, that I pay you to do something, either to pass legislation or to, write in a regulatory provision or something that benefits me, and that my giving you money creates some kind of obligation that you feel beholden to me because I did that. And so they have said pretty consistently through the years that it's okay to regulate that process, that you can put limits on how much you can actually give to candidates or you can give to political parties. But once you get beyond exchanging, passing the money directly to those people, then this free speech business becomes more important.
Mm. Let's talk with a caller. We have someone here, Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Yeah. On the super PACs, I don't know whether you mentioned or not. I've been listening sort of where some of them were set up as a nonprofit, and they don't have to report anything, right?
Yeah, we haven't really talked about that yet, and that's a really important part of the problem. The super PACs that we're talking about are the organizations that have chosen to register with the Federal Election Commission, to disclose their donors, to report all their spending. Anybody now can spend money this way. So General Motors, GE, anybody can do independent expenditures, could run these ads. And that includes groups that are not registered with the FEC as a PAC, or in this case as a super PAC, but they're called public education organizations. And there's a whole range of them. It includes everything from the Sierra Club and Right to Life organizations, other kinds of groups that have really important that are focused on issues or some kind of policy outcomes. They can also make these expenditures now because nobody has any restrictions there.
My disclosure
of where that money comes from is really much more. In fact, it doesn't exist. They have to report the spending if it meets certain kinds of requirements, like if it's very specifically vote for this person or defeat this other person, then they have to report that they spent the money, but they never have to show where it came from, and that's a really serious problem. Even in the Supreme Court, there were 8 members of the court who agreed that while there couldn't be any limits on the spending of this money, there absolutely had to be disclosure, that was a fundamental principle. And Justice Scalia, in fact, has been one of the most important advocates for saying, you can do this if you want to, but you need to stand up and say that you've done it. And in the way this has worked out for these what are called C4 organizations, which is basically about the tax code, but it's these public interest groups, as long as they're not doing this with a majority of their money, then there's no disclosure, and that's a real problem.
Is these tax deductible?
No contributions to political organizations are tax deductible. No, the groups, these C4 groups, are called tax exempt, and what that means is they don't pay income tax on the money that they raise and spend. But there are not necessarily tax benefits for the people who give to them. There's certainly no, they're not charities. So they don't count, for example, as charitable deductions for individual people who make contributions to them. So no, they're not really deductible that way.
All right. And to another caller, Paris, and this is line number 4. Hello. Caller there, line 4. Well, okay, I guess we could check and see if there is. Otherwise, we have about 12, 13 minutes left in this part of Focus. If you'd like to join in the conversation, we're talking about campaign finance. Our guest for the program is Bob Biersack. He is a senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington, D.C. And if you're interested in finding out more about the center, you can go to their website, and that is opensecrets.org. And I do think we have somebody there on our line 4 right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
My thought on this whole thing was this super PACs and stuff like that. My concern is the chance of foreign entities getting their money involved in it, China or, you know, whoever, and, you know, having influence on our politics. And from what I understand, they can do this. They can kind of sneaky pee it in a back door, and you don't really know where those contributions are coming from. So I'd like to hear you speak on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, is that possible?
It's an interesting problem. There is still a prohibition on foreign nationals, making contributions in American elections, and that's true across the board, state, local, federal, doesn't matter. But how do you administer that? How do you enforce that? And the New York Times has a very important story on the front page today that's an example of the potential for this kind of problem, where the Obama campaign, which actually discloses the set of people who collect contributions in these limited amounts and then pass them along. They're called bundlers. And often they can collect lots and lots of money and then bring it into the campaign, but still all in these limited amounts. One of these bundlers turns out to be a group of family members and associates of someone who is a fugitive from justice who is living in Mexico and is apparently a very wealthy casino owner and has some problematic ties, I gather, according to the story, in Mexico. And so it's relatives of his. Now, that's not to suggest that this is foreign money, but he has been trying to get a pardon from the state of Iowa, I gather, about some charges that he had run away from effectively many years ago. Now, whether or not anybody thought that bundling contributions to the president's campaign was going to benefit them in that context, hard to know. But this is a problem that we've seen before. It's not unique to this to the Obama campaign. The Clinton campaign in 2008 had a similar problem with somebody who just popped up on the scene, raised lots of money. It turns out that was money that this individual person was giving to other people so they could contribute to the Clinton candidacy, so he could raise his presence in the political class in Washington. And that, of course, is also illegal. So technically, theoretically, legally, no, the Chinese government or other kind of foreign nationals are still prohibited from contributing to the political process in the United States, but we were just talking about the fact that these organizations like the C4s will not be disclosing their donors, and so it's not clear how you enforce that. And it's one of the things that many people are concerned about.
All right. Another caller, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. It seems to me, while the previous caller's concern was justified, that perhaps a more probable danger is the contributions of multinationals affecting election outcomes.
Yeah, here again, they're not contributing specifically to the candidates, but they can spend the money. We've had interest at the center from media organizations in Switzerland and Brazil, throughout the country, where, as you say, multinational corporations, as long as you have a presence in the United States, if you have an American subsidiary, then that subsidiary is allowed to have a PAC, it's allowed to participate in the process in every way, including presumably making independent expenditures. So as the world gets more complex and more global, it becomes much harder to sort that sort of thing out.
Other questions? Welcome. 5-6 minutes left in this hour of focus. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to ask you to react to something that I in one of the many opinion pieces that I've read on where we are right now. The person who writes this suggested that really the problem here has been the result of this effort, now going back some time, to limit direct individual contributions to candidates or parties. That was something that goes back to post-Watergate time. That's really when the individual limits came into effect. And that what this person is arguing, that the by putting limits on what individuals might contribute, that in fact now groups have become much more powerful, much bigger, wealthier, more influential, and in fact that has come at the expense of the political parties. Do you think that that is true?
Actually, the parties have fared surprisingly well, I think, during this whole process. The system is more and more structured to be harder for them, I suppose, because they live under contribution limits. But you know, you can give as an individual person $30,800 to a national party committee if you want to today. So I'm not sure how meaningful that kind of, you know, that's a lot of money. That shouldn't be a huge limit. And the parties have managed to find new resources. The flip side of that question, that the real problem is that these limitations are too low or that they exist at all, the flip side of that is kind of looking at it is there a way to make sure that lots more organizations, not just a narrow set, could have access to significant fundraising in small dollar amounts? Technology, the thing that the Obama campaign in 2008 showed us most clearly was that the technology today has changed so much that it actually is possible to raise astounding amounts of money in really quite small denomination contributions from lots of people, if you can energize them, if they make the decision that they want to participate this way, then it's possible. There are programs at the state and local level. The most successful or the best known is one in New York City, where a public financing program exists where there is a kind of a multiplier for if you get contributions in small amounts. The city government not only matches it, but it matches it 4-1 or 6-1, making those small contributions much more important and more meaningful and more useful. It goes back to the idea that it's not necessarily that you have to – the person with the most money doesn't always win. They usually do, but there are other reasons why. Everybody who wins an election against an incumbent, for example, almost all the challengers who beat incumbents spend less than the challenger did, but they spend enough to get their message across, enough for people to understand where they're coming from in terms of their policy preferences, things like that. And then people make the decision on their own. There are lots of examples of people who spend, the more they spend, the worse they do, because the more visible they are, the more people decide, well, this is not really the person that I'm interested in having run the government in some way. So the relationship between money and winning is not perfect. But you can look at that question from two different angles, I think. It would certainly be easier for some people to raise money if you got rid of contribution limits. But then disclosure becomes much more important. And you continue to have this problem of a smaller and smaller group of people much more heavily involved in the campaign process than the rest of America. You know, it gets to this 1%, 99% question in some ways. To me, the better approach is how can we help people across the board have more resources so they're able to at least make their case, and then people decide in the voting booth what they're going to do.
Yeah. Just we're coming down to that, we have a couple of minutes left. I think that we talked earlier about the U.S. Supreme Court and its interest in being careful about putting limits on spending because of the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. I think some people have said, well, maybe that could be changed. And in fact, I read that Ron Wyden, who is a Democratic senator from Oregon, is proposing an amendment that would give Congress the power to regulate spending for federal campaigns. And I don't know that there's really all that much support for that. I think one of his colleagues, in fact, in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, who's the minority leader, has been one of the strongest opponents of reform in the Congress. Right. So there's certainly no agreement there. Do you think that avenue, the idea that the Constitution could be amended to allow for some limits, do you think that has any possibility of going anywhere?
I think that's just a really hard and very long-term process. You know, you have to get 2/3 of the states involved to agree. It's just really complex and difficult. I think there are other things that can be done on the margins that could be very effective. We could improve the disclosure process pretty significantly, so that at least, as some of your colleagues have said, at least we'll know who's doing what to whom. We'll know where this money comes from, and so we can protect ourselves from some of the potential problems here. I think it's an interesting argument that the Montana Supreme Court is actually making. They refused to withdraw their restrictions on corporate spending and union spending directly in state elections in Montana because they said we can prove that there's a corruption problem when companies can spend unlimited funds because in the history of their state where mining interests basically controlled their state government for many years, this was a problem. And so they have made a counterargument to the one that the Supreme Court made suggesting that you can't corrupt public officials by independently spending. We'll see how that plays out in litigation. That obviously won't end there. So the Supreme Court's going to have to face these questions again. And maybe over time, as we see how this works, what kinds of problems we encounter, maybe changes come a little more incrementally than a big constitutional amendment. Hmm.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that for the moment. And I again want to mention, if people are interested in reading more about the subject of money and politics, you certainly could go and should go to the website of the Center for Responsive Politics. That's opensecrets.org, and that is a place where our guest Bob Biersack works. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics. And thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
David, it was my pleasure. Thank you.